Lockdown backlash in China and abandon hope, all ye who dine here. We'll discuss all this and more on this edition of The Editors. I'm Rich Lowry. I'm joined, as always, by the Right Honorable Charles C.W. Cook, the Sage of Authenticity Woods, Jim Garrity, and the notorious M.B.D., Michael Brendan Doherty. You are, of course, listening to a National View podcast. Our sponsors this episode are Fire, Babel, and the paperback edition of Brian Kilmeade's book, The President and the Freedom Fighter. If for some reason you're not already following us on a streaming service, you can find us everywhere from Spotify to iTunes. If you like what you hear here, please consider giving us a glowing five-star review on iTunes. If you don't like what you hear here, please forget I said anything. And before I do anything else, a message from our friends at the aforementioned Fire. Do you know only 1 in 3 Americans believe we can fully exercise our free speech rights? That's why Fire is stepping up to protect freedom of expression for all Americans, no matter where you're from or what you believe. The Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, or FIRE, knows free speech makes free people. FIRE will always be a principled, nonpartisan, nonprofit defender of your rights. Join the fight for free speech at www.thefire.org. That's www.thefire.org. So, Jim, speaking of fire or firestorms, we had one over the weekend about this instantly notorious dinner between Kanye West, or Yee, and Yee brought a guest along. Who else? Nick Fuentes. Everyone was there except for Kyrie Irving and Louis Farrakhan, I guess. But Trump said he didn't know anything about Nick Fuentes. But notably, despite making repeated statements about this dinner afterwards, has not said one word condemning Nick Fuentes. And then there's the judgment question of dining with Yee in the first place, given the last couple of weeks that guy has had. What do you make of it?
Well, in addition to that other parade of the bar scene in Star Wars coming through Mar-a-Lago, Rich, you forgot to mention that Milo Yiannopoulos, who is running Kanye West's 2024 presidential campaign,
I didn't know he hired a campaign manager. It's Milo?
Yes, he's getting serious. Now, when you put
my favorite detail from this dinner was Kanye apparently asked Trump to be his running mate. Which would solve a lot of problems, actually. Save us a lot of trouble.
That is the only thing he has said that has offended Donald Trump in the last couple of months. So when you put together Trump, Kanye, Fuentes, and Milo, you've basically put together my Mount Rushmore of human beings I prefer to never hear from ever again. There's a part of me that hates the fact that we even have to talk about Nick Fuentes, because up until now, you could ignore him doing his idiotic little anti-Semitic Holocaust-denying BS shtick, and there's lots of other words that I will not use because it's allegedly a family podcast. We have to talk about him because the former president of the United States had dinner with them and decided to invite Kanye, who said he was going to go on, quote, DEFCON 3 with the Jews. Now, Kanye West's anti-Semitism is so ignorant and so ill-informed, he can't even be bothered to look up the DEFCON schedule. It's deaf, not death, and 3 is right in the middle. So presumably, he meant to go to DEFCON 1, highest level of alert, but no, or DEFCON 3, or DEFCON 5, which would be the lowest level of alert. No, he just throws it all out there.
So in his defense, Jim, I've always been, and I pay a lot of attention to nuclear affairs, I've always been confused about what's the highest level of DEFCON.
1. Who's number 1? The one at the top. That's the easiest, easy way to remember. I just kind of look at this, and I've never voted for Trump. My opinion on him is clear. I try to give him credit when he does stuff I like, but by and large, he's getting nuttier and crazier and even more self-destructive and outwardly destructive as well. If I had a mind control device trying to sabotage his chances to run for president in 2024, I don't know if I could have come up with a scenario like this. And mind you, he just decided to announce he was running for president 1 week after the midterms. We've still got a runoff going on in Georgia, but he couldn't wait. And the first major decision he does is to have dinner with Kanye, where the only thing Kanye says that bothers him is that Trump should be his vice president. Republicans, are you sure you want to go in this direction?
So, MBD, it's, I don't know whether there's ever going to be an inflection point with Trump. That's really stark. Andy had a good piece over the weekend saying, actually, he thinks, it's going to be like the bankruptcy famous bankruptcy quote, you know, very, very gradually, and then all at once, and the all at once might be imminent, but just a little straw in the wind for me. I do this New York WABC radio show every Monday morning, Sid and Bernie show. Bernie McGurk, unfortunately, passed away several weeks ago. It's Sid Rosenberg is now taken. He's just a great guy, a genius on radio, and a really strong Trump supporter. And this morning he's just like, you know what? This might be it for me. You know, I'm a strong Jew. I love the Jewish people. I was hell on Kyrie Irving. Why do I need this? You know? And so he wasn't definitely saying he's done, but he sounded more done than he's ever been before. And you're picking that up anecdotally.
Yeah, you're definitely picking that up. I mean, you know, the only thing Trump said sort of in his defense was, I did not know Nick mm-hmm. Fuentes, which I can believe. What's bad, though, is that former presidents should have people around them vetting who gets to get near them. Like, just sorry. I mean, like, Nixon used to have guys around, you know, like people that he hired that would keep crazies away from them.
Nixon wouldn't even see Elvis when he showed up at the White House without a great deal of convincing.
Yeah. So this is part of the failure around Trump. And it's a distressing one in that, like, you begin to ask the question, is this what gets sucked into the vacuum around Trump when, you know, Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump are no longer part of the political operation of, you know, Trump world? And, you know, we saw how Trump tended to alienate the few people he could bring on into his world and his staff at the White House. So, like, is this an indication of, like, how far down in the barrel he's going to be scraping for friends mm-hmm. and allies in the future going forward? I think it's actually pretty, pretty worrying. Mm-hmm. It's not just a one-off.
Yeah, I have it on good authority that Phil Klein is about to post something in the corner making exactly this case. You like this? Just wait till the second term.
Yeah.
So, Charlie, the dynamic, though, among the party generally about this has been the same as it's been for 5 years. Maybe a real slight hint towards a condemnation. James Comer, the incoming oversight chairman, was on Meet the Press and was asked about this. He's like, well, you know, he should have maybe showed better judgment about who he's dining with. But otherwise, it's the ducking and the covering, which at a certain level I've understood all along, but also at a certain point just becomes totally cowardly and dishonorable.
I'm in two minds about that. I think if a politician or public figure who is associated in some way with the American right is asked directly, what do you think about this? They should say so. They should condemn it. They should be forthright. I think what Maggie Haberman did a couple of days ago and say, we haven't had a statement from DeSantis and he's the governor of the state, was ridiculous. It's not incumbent upon anyone who is in Florida or of the Republican Party to ex nihilo issue statements for the behavior of other people at events to which they weren't invited and with which they had nothing to do.
DeSantis failed to send in the National Guard into Mar-a-Lago, Charlie. Could have saved
him. Yeah, well, Trump's really gone too far when DeSantis sends migrants to Mar-a-Lago.
I think on the specific question, it shows two things. The first is that irrespective of what you think it says about Trump's heart, which is quite difficult for anyone to discern from afar, it shows that he's extraordinarily careless. And if it is true, as he and his supporters say, that we're approaching an inflection point in American history, that the country is about to be lost, that's not my view for what it's worth, but that is their case, then they should be a lot more careful and make it seem as if they believe it. The second thing is that it just reminds, or should remind, Republican primary voters of all of the nonsense that comes along with whatever it is that they like about Trump. I am not, as listeners to this podcast will know, a big fan of Jonathan Chait. But Jonathan Chait, back when the Democratic primary of 2019-2020 was in full swing, made a good point about Bernie Sanders. The Bernie faction within the party said, you know, Republicans are going to call Democrats socialists whatever they do. And Chait said, yes, but it's a lot easier to push back against it when you don't say, yes, I am. If the Democrats had nominated Bernie, the Republican ads would have said Bernie is a socialist. And the Democrats would have said, yeah, he is. Well, Biden said, I'm not, and that helped him win. There is a view emerging among Trump's most hardened acolytes that it doesn't matter what Trump does because the press is unfair to Republicans, because the Democrats are unfair to Republicans. And that's not true. It is true that the press is unfair to Republicans, and it is true that many of the things that Democrats say about Republicans are inaccurate. But it helps when you can say no. Mm-hmm. It helps when you can credibly push back and say, actually, that isn't true. And if you look at the other candidates who I imagine are lining up to run in 2024, they have a lot more latitude, credible, plausible, true latitude to say no. There is no suggestion that Ron DeSantis pals around with anti-Semites. There is no suggestion that Greg Abbott or Brian Kemp or Kristi Noem or Tim Scott or whoever you like pals around with anti-Semites. So yeah, some of the Republicans who run are going to be accused of racism and intolerance. But it matters that it's true, or at least that it appears to be true in Trump's case. And I hope that this, at the very least, has shown once again that all of that baggage that comes along with Trump is self-inflicted and unnecessary.
So, Jim Garrity, exit question to you. If you look at the polling average nationally, which I'm not doing right at the moment, so I'll be a little fuzzy on these numbers, but Trump's in the high 40s, more than 10 points ahead of Ron DeSantis. You consider that a true reading of Donald Trump's strength, or B, a false reading based on Trump being more famous than everyone else still and being a former president? So it's not a true indication of where he stands in the prospective Republican primary. B, that's B.
I would lean towards the latter. It's November 2022. Republicans have a long time before they have to make this decision. Nobody's going to be casting any ballots that matter until January 2024. So I think, you know, when you see the two guys, presuming it's Trump and DeSantis, and we may see other candidates jumping in, I think that will be the real measurement. When they've seen the two next to each other, when they've seen them have disagreements, I think that will be a more accurate measure. But it's measuring the state of things now. But again, that's that old saying, you know, if the election were held today, people would be confused because they think it's the first Tuesday in November.
MBD.
It's the latter. I think Nate Silver made a pretty convincing case that when you begin adjusting DeSantis' numbers for his national name recognition, it looks really close already. And DeSantis has a ton of room to grow. So, I think Trump is fading, but, you know, I'm not going to start placing money on it yet.
Yeah, I remember I was on Bill Kristol's video cast the day after Iowa in 2016, and at some point, you know, we're going over what happened and why. And he's like, "Rich, so we finally reached peak Trump." It's like, "Nope, I'm not using that phrase ever again," because it was so wrong up to that point, and ended up being wrong after Iowa. But Charlie, I guess what I'm asking, if you want to rephrase it, is whether the 47 or 48 or whatever it is peak Trump.
I mean, like you, I've been wrong about this in the past, and it makes me nervous to put on the record that I think it will be different this time. But I suppose I do think it will be different this time. So, yes, I do think it's peak Trump, and I do think it's slowly slipping away.
I think it's a false read. I don't know how much of a false read. I don't think he's going to get 49% against Ron DeSantis in these contests when push comes to shove. But I don't know how much lower he is than that. We'll have to find out. I will say, and this is not a prediction, that if Trump gets into Iowa and begins to lose altitude, it might be that there's not, you know, the bottom is quite low. Once it's clear, you know, he's giving way. If he's in third place in Iowa, you know, it the bottom could fall out for him, but we're very far from that happening, and it might not ever happen. So with that, let's pause and hear from our second sponsor this episode, Babbel. This holiday season, if you're looking for a unique gift that inspires curiosity, travel, and culture, give the gift of Babbel. Babbel is a language learning app that sold more than 10 million subscriptions. Thanks to Babbel's addictively fun and easy bite-sized language lessons, you'll finally be able to discover the wonder that comes with learning a new language. With Babbel, you only need 10 minutes to complete a lesson, so you can start having real-life conversations in a new language in as little as 3 weeks. Other language learning apps use AI for the lesson plans, but Babbel's lessons were created by over 150 language experts and voiced by real native speakers, not computers. Their teaching method has been scientifically proven to be effective. With Babbel, you can choose from 14 different languages, including Spanish, French, Italian, and German. Plus, Babbel's speech recognition technology helps you to improve your pronunciation and accent. There's so many ways to learn with Babbel. In additional lessons, you can access podcasts, games, video stories, and even live classes. Plus, it comes with a 20-day money-back guarantee. Start your new language learning journey today with Babbel. Right now, get up to 55% off. That's 55% off your subscription when you go to babbel.com/editors. That's babbel.com/editors for up to 55% off your subscription. Babbel, language for life. Please check it out. So, Jim, we have some potentially historic goings on in China. There have been protests all over the country against the extreme COVID zero lockdowns. Counter to the image, there are protests against the government all the time in China. It's just usually at the local level, you know, some local officials high-handed or corrupt, and you'll have protests. And they're also usually undertaken by, as a friend was explaining to me just a little while ago, by the lower stratum of society, migrant workers, that sort of thing. But what's different here, this has really been led by the middle class, by people who have apartments and don't want to be locked into them. Students have joined in and lent a kind of a broader political intellectual cast to these protests, making it about democracy and freedom of expression. They're holding up blank pages to symbolize censorship in China. What do you make of it?
So I think there are three important lessons for those of us here in the United States and probably for the broader world. One is, you know, for about a year, we argued whether zero COVID was the smarter policy, was the better policy, was the more effective one. And you could find coverage in places like the New York Times and Bloomberg and other places like, China's really figured this out and really is making the West look like a bunch of stumble bums. Yes, they may look tough and draconian to the outside, but their policies have worked while Americans have had X number of deaths at this point, et cetera. Well, I think that debate is over, and those of us who were always skeptical or critical of zero COVID have won and won definitively. It is late November, and COVID-19 is an afterthought in American life, whereas China is still shutting down cities to the point where not just have they, you know, sacrificed enormous economic growth and jobs and untold levels of human suffering. Oh, by the way, their COVID-19 statistics are all nonsense, and I've had this argument with a lot of people who claim to be China experts, who seem weirdly credulous about officials from the Chinese Communist official statistics from the Chinese Communist Party. Look, COVID, zero COVID isn't workable. It never worked. It was always delaying the inevitable, and now they're really in deep doo doo because their vaccines are not as effective as the vaccines here in the United States. Second important lesson, I think, is that you look at this, you look at the protests in Iran, you look at the short lived, but still, I think I want to give them credit for trying protests against Putin in Russia. A lot of people make fun of George W. Bush and the freedom is the yearning of every human heart argument. And yeah, you can take it too far. There are some people in this world who don't want freedom. There are some people in this world who want to be oppressors. There are some people who prefer stability. But there is this point where human beings will say, that's enough. Stop pushing me around. Stop making me do these things. Just let me live my life. And that's what we're seeing here in China. And we've got to wish them every success in this. I think the third one is just this lesson of, look, there's no doubt China's dangerous militarily. They've attempted to exert a great deal of influence. They got the world's largest navy. They want to take over Taiwan. They're committing genocide. There's a lot of reasons to fear China. But Xi Jinping, sometimes he seems kind of dumb. That's the theme of today's jolt today. Like, it's a message of like, if he's not dumb, he's reckless. He makes a bad decision, like, you know, zero COVID policies. And then he will not back off of them no matter how bad it gets, because he has to look perfect, because he has to look infallible. So I think you add all that up and we have a very powerful potential enemy in China, but also a reckless one, mm-hmm. in which the usual, you know, common sense or the usual ability to accept feedback and adjust course isn't functioning, which probably makes them even more dangerous in the long run.
Yeah, that's not a great combination, as we've seen with Putin, but Putin at a lower level of power. So MBD, that kind of infallibility, it's not just about Z, it's about the party. You know, the party is demonstrating its omniscience here. It can control totally this virus. Again, this friend I was just talking to a little while ago compared it to Mao killing all the sparrows. Now, why would you kill all the sparrows? Well, part of it's just to prove the point. Yeah, you can kill the sparrows. You can kill all the sparrows. Sparrows are extremely adaptive species, by the way, who thrive on being around human beings and human structures. But anyway, we're going to go kill them because the Chinese Communist Party can do it. And same here. The Chinese Communist Party can stomp out every case of COVID, demonstrating its superiority to every other system of government where, you know, whether you've been Sweden or whether you've been California or in between, you know, everyone has suffered significant illness and death during the course of this pandemic. But China is going to be different. And that's a huge element of what's been driving this.
Yeah, and that's the self-delusion of the Chinese Communist Party. I actually don't think most Chinese people bought into that pretension ever. You know, I'm cautious when I look at protests in places like Iran or China, in the sense of like, does this really represent a majority? Does this, is this really, you know, or is this something that I'm projecting onto them that I want to see? But when I've, you know, what I've read about China in the last year, or learned about on this fascinating podcast series by The Economist on Xi Jinping, is that for hundreds of millions of Chinese people, really the proof in the pudding for the Chinese state is prosperity, is that mm-hmm. life is noticeably better and richer now in China than it was 20 years ago, and especially than it was 40, 50, and 60 years ago. That there are a lot of people that still remember the deprivations of the Cultural Revolution, of the periods before it. And China's growth has been sort of the proof of the wisdom of the Chinese Communist Party's leadership, even with all of the downsides that have come with it. And what I think at least is interesting as a question for these protests is, has COVID presented a challenge to the Chinese Communist Party that actually hammers at this exact point in their credibility, which is that, in fact, standards of living are not going up in China anymore. They may be going into reverse. For a lot of people, they're going into reverse in a very personal way, as they're not going to work. They're not allowed to work. They're being provided rations rather than earning and improving their lives themselves. You know, I think Xi Jinping's project was in part to kind of assert the party's role over and above the economy again. And maybe we're seeing in COVID, we're seeing that project falter and fail.
Yeah, so Charlie, a couple other things. One is, you know, free speech for a lot of people is an abstraction. You're the average person in China. Are you going to put your life on the line or your freedom on the line in order to fight for free speech? Probably not, you know, unless you're really committed. And there are some people who, God bless them, are really committed there. But the lockdowns have affected everyone, right? It's not an abstraction. If someone gets COVID in your apartment complex and there's a padlock on your door, you know, an hour later, or in your local town, and this was the precipitating event for this round of protests, was there was a fire where supposedly the firefighters couldn't get there to react to it fast enough because of the COVID lockdown policies. I mean, that's something very tangible that affects everyone.
Yeah, I think I slightly disagree on this, in that I think that what we're seeing is a selfish middle class experiment in human sacrifice, and that China is about to see how many people need to lose their lives to shore up the economy. What you could say is that the Chinese are now the largely unwilling canaries in an invisible coal mine sent to find out just how many individuals need to lose their job or their life for a state to work through a plague, by Amanda Mull. Look, the distinction that you draw between a proximate cause and a broader challenge is, I think, much flatter than it seems, in that there's always something that highlights the problem with the underlying government. You know, the French Revolution was not about the Bastille, and Chernobyl was not about poor maintenance of a nuclear power plant, but a system that could not adapt or tell the truth. And so while it sometimes takes an incident that is real to people, in this case a fire, to highlight the problem, the prerequisite issues are ultimately what is being protested, and that I think is the case in China. The love affair that many in the West have had with China is grotesque, but it's not new. For 100 years now, many people in free countries have fallen in love with what they perceive to be the efficiency of totalitarianism. Writers were saying similar things about the Soviet Union in the 1920s and afterwards. Thomas Friedman likes to fantasize about being China for a day because China doesn't have any of the impediments to unchecked state action that the United States has by design. Now, I'm not going to suggest that everyone who has been a COVID hawk agrees with everything that China has done, welding people into their apartments, for example. But by lionizing the lack of checks and balances, whether those be constitutional, judicial, democratic, or legislative, they are in effect endorsing and justifying China's overreach, and they are indulging a system that was always going to end up where China now has, which is with police officers dressed in full protective gear roaming the streets and pushing people around. And I would always rather be in a Florida or a Georgia than I would in that situation. The Chinese government can't even allow open debate. This is a small but instructive example that the World Cup broadcasts in China do not show the crowds because the crowds aren't wearing masks.
Mm.
And this is not a conspiracy theory. This is not an online rumor. This has been confirmed now. That
so, so they couldn't see the crowd going crazy during the 0-0 USA-England match?
They either don't show the crowd at all or they blur it out. And that is ultimately a sign of weakness. And I would just say as a broader point that I think that the anti-liberals on left and right ought to consider where we are in the world at the moment. I saw somebody, I can't remember who, pointing this out on Twitter, and I thought it was absolutely correct. The United States is imperfect and has issues, but it's in a pretty good place. It's low unemployment. Yes, we have many problems with inflation, and the government is to blame for a great deal of our ills, but I would not want to be anywhere other than the United States right now. And after that, I would want to be in Europe or Australia or Canada or Britain. And the nations that don't have the institutional strength that the areas I just mentioned have are looking pretty bad. Russia is much weaker than we thought it was, and it's got itself into a terrible stalemate in Ukraine. China has failed in its COVID zero policy. It's facing middle class backlash. Its economy is stagnant. It's losing population.
But the train stations look nice.
Well, screw the train stations. And I would just remind anyone who feels tempted towards that autocratic instinct, it doesn't work. It won't work. And eventually, as we've seen here, whether it's precipitated by people knocking down a wall or a fire, the bill will become due.
So, Charlie, we'll lift the curtain a little bit. We almost talked about what would have been your least favorite editor's topic ever, the impending rail strike, which would have combined two of your least favorite items, railroads and an unreasonable union potentially sabotaging the national economy. But we decided not to talk about that, at least not this week. And, you know, I just wholeheartedly agree. You know, our system is in important respects inefficient, but the inefficiency is a feature, not a bug. You know, and in a lot of places you can't have a Florida or a Georgia, right? Because there's not a federal system. And part of the beauty of America is you have these rival power centers where you have the executive, the legislative branch, and the judiciary all pushing against each other, and various states can go their own ways. And that's a way to kind of reveal errors, to find a better way to do things, and then over time come to a kind of consensus rather than forced edicts coming down from the top. So Jim Garrity asks a question to you. China, the Chinese regime, will find a way to get past this moment without another Tiananmen Square type event, a massacre, or the regime getting fundamentally destabilized. They'll find a way to manage their way through this, yes or no. And it is, they're on the horns of a real dilemma, because if they really loosen up on the COVID restrictions, there's a chance of this virus totally running out of control, given that there's no natural immunity, given that for whatever bizarre reason, they haven't been very successful or forceful insisting that the elderly get vaccinated. And on top of that, the vaccine is at least kind of a B-level type vaccine, not top-notch. So they'll find a way to get past this, yes or no?
They'll definitely get past it. I do think this will be a key, like 30 years from now, we'll look back at this and say, okay, the Chinese government's inability to really handle COVID and the sticking with this insane zero COVID policy broke, severely damaged the public's trust and acquiescence to Xi Jinping. I just don't know how the rest of it's going to shake out.
MBD.
They'll get past this. This is survivable for that regime.
Charlie.
I think they'll get past it in this instance. I don't think we're going to see some mass uprising that causes the fall or diminishment of the Chinese Communist Party. But I do think that it may be the beginning of a change that alters China's future, in that essentially, whether or not the government accepts it, all societies are contingent upon the consent of the governed. And if the middle classes in China withdraw that consent en masse, then the Chinese Communist Party will become unsustainable and it will need to change or wither.
So they'll find a way past this. It'll involve kind of fake loosening up. And if that doesn't kind of take some of the air out of these protests, they'll just do what they need to do, mass arrests or even a more violent crackdown. This regime will eventually fall. It's just a question of how much harm they can do to the Chinese people and to the world and to us before that happens. With that, let's hear from our third sponsor of this episode. The latest bestseller from Fox and Friends host Brian Kilmeade is now available in paperback. The President and the Freedom Fighter tells the inspiring true story of the friendship between Frederick Douglass and President Abraham Lincoln in classic Kilmeade style. This book takes a little-known slice of American history and makes it a page-turning story, perfect for the history buff on your holiday list. Learn more about the President and the Freedom Fighter now in paperback at briankilmeade.com. briankilmeade.com. Brian is a great guy and has a cottage industry going in these really entertaining American history books. So please check it out. Again, briankilmeade.com. So MBD, we've had another spate of horrific shootings, including one at a gay club in Colorado, Club Q, and it's just been instructive and predictable, unfortunately. The reaction to this, no one waited to find out anything about the shooter, who kind of classic case, his family was afraid of him. He threatened to blow up his, I believe it was his mother's house. There's some clips of video clips of when the police arrived and clearly just out of his mind, ranting about taking down these cops, et cetera, et cetera. And his lawyers say that, you know, they're defense lawyers, so we'll have to see as proceedings go along, but say that he's non-binary and his pronouns are they and them. But there was a rush to condemn this as an act of homophobia, and this contention about his non-binary nature has, of course, had zero impact on the commentary from the media and the left on the shooting. What do you make of it?
Oh, I think it had a little effect. I think it slowed down the gathering of steam for the left, saying that, like, oh, all of this is the result of Ron DeSantis and Don't Say Gay Bill and the ongoing backlash against queer rights or something like that, however they want to characterize, you know, people who object to, you know, whatever, drag queen story hour at the local library or at preschool or whatever. Or all ages drag shows, things like that. You know, there was a moment where the left was saying, okay, there's an irrational backlash to these things, and that's motivating hate crimes. So that's quieted down a little bit while people figure.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, you know, I guess the homophobia thing didn't even show up on the Sunday show, so I think you're right about that.
Yeah, try but of course that's what people leapt to. You know, and of course, why not? I mean, it's kind of a proven part of the playbook. I mean, Matthew Shepard's awful killing was kind of turned into a giant fable for decades, and then turned into, you know, and put on film screenplays, completely misrepresenting what happened there in order to turn it into like an instructive, you know, victim moment, right? And, you know, I've written about this in the magazine about how there's this desire to use these tragedies as an occasion for social transformation, right? Like, like once you see the horror of the crime and the hatred, your human sympathies will immediately go to the victim, and then society will be in some way transformed by the victim into something better. That's a deep instinct in Christian civilization. It's ineradicable. But in a way, like, it's the way we're expressing that in our culture now is obviously sick. And in a way it almost feeds into these crimes. Yeah, I mean, I think.
What do you mean? What do you mean feeds into the crimes?
I think people want to enter these grand narratives of like struggle, and in a sense, like, it drives more publicity to the crime itself, which potentially attracts more of these copycat mass shooters.
as opposed to everyone just treating them as garden variety murders.
Yeah. And you know, I'm sure I'm not the only one who, when these crimes kind of come across social media, as they do almost immediately, like, my instinct is to turn off the news for a day, because mm-hmm. I know that there's going to be this almost rote script of blame, scapegoating, pushback, and it's pretty disgusting. In fact, it's like, it is itself disrespectful to the victims, right? Like, because it's like we're saying, okay, the murders aren't important. The ideology is, and the score, yeah. the kind of weird scorecard we're all keeping.
Yeah. So speaking of scorecards, Charlie, our friend John Gabriel at Ricochet has a scorecard or grid on how to know which narrative is going to be pushed after one of these terrible events. For instance, if it's, you know, a police officer shoots a black man, it's police brutality. A black man shoots a police officer, it's reaction to police brutality. And a black man shoots a black man, it's gun control.
You said that the Sunday shows didn't focus on the homophobia angle. That's because they had gun control to fall back on. That was their topic. I am afraid that John Gabriel is right. And others who have noticed that the press's interest in shootings is contingent upon the immutable characteristics of those on either side of the gun are right as well. The general topic tends to be flattened somewhat, such that if somebody shoots five people with a handgun in a domestic dispute, the president will go out and say we need a ban on so-called assault weapons. But the details do have an effect on the coverage. And we saw this with the three incidents to which you referred from the last two or three weeks. The shooting in Virginia at the Walmart was worse in terms of its body count, but it got less attention because it was not easily plugged into our pre-existing culture wars. The shooting in Colorado does not yet have a stated motive, but that hasn't stopped a great deal of coverage and finger pointing and even shouting and hysteria in the press. And of course, the routine declaration of who is now obliged to be quiet, which is what the press does in response to every story that comes across its desk. Nancy Pelosi's husband is hit by a hammer. Republicans must be quiet. There's a shooting at a gay club. Well, Michelle Goldberg in the New York Times compiled an entire list. Ben Shapiro, Matt Walsh, Christina Pushaw, Ron DeSantis' press secretary, and others were named after the point in the piece at which Goldberg had conceded that there was no motive. As Michael says, the instinct is to turn off the television and close Twitter, not because one wants to avoid discussion of or contemplation of these crimes. We should never do that. But because the manner in which they are now discussed, all the way from the sewers of Twitter up to previously respectable Sunday shows, is dumb. Dumb and self-serving and censorious and grotesque. And we feel, I think, as a country, as if we always have the same conversations when these news items hit the transom. And we do, and that's because we never actually talk about them in a way that a normal culture would.
So, Jim, even if this shooter it proves to be a terrible homophobe, there's still no connection to conservative complaints about drag queen story hour. If you look at what conservatives say about these kind of issues, it's not suffused with a hatred of gay people. It's just like, wow, maybe it's inappropriate to have a stripper cavorting in front of small children. I mean, if that's now homophobia, we've defined the term way, way, way down.
Yeah, no, the dominant message from some corners of the media for the past year, maybe 2 years, maybe 3 years, has been the best way to ensure that no one is targeted for their sexuality or gender identity or anything like that is to never say anything is wrong in any concept in any way, shape, or form whatsoever, which most of us look at that and say, no, no, it's not the way it works. I don't have a ton to add to what Michael and Charlie said, but I will kind of, you know, observe what we're seeing, what's becoming more and more transparent here is that something comes along, some news story. And I like it when it's something like the recent thing with FTX or GameStop, something that's kind of new and different and doesn't automatically have this easily digestible right versus left story. Because almost everything that comes down the pike, whether it's these awful mass shootings, economic troubles, social troubles, almost any story comes into, you know, an Aesop's fable in the eyes of the media. And that's why you shouldn't vote for Republicans. And that's why the Democrats are right about this one. Right? Now, the job of the news used to be just tell us what's going on and we'll decide what we want to, what we think about that. The op-ed page was there to say, well, here are some interesting people who have some thoughts on, you know, what this news means, what it means if there are mass shootings, what it means if inflation is high, what it means if we're seeing these protests in China. Here's what you should think about it. And one, obviously, the line between news and op-ed, you know, straight news reporting and op-eds has gotten a lot blurrier over the time. But the other thing is that there are certain people who, as Charlie and Michael, you know, so ably demonstrated, they have a flow chart that always comes to the same result. And this is why Democrats are right, and this is why Republicans are wrong. And it always comes down to that in one form or another. And as a result, the news gets very boring. The news gets very predictable. And if you happen to disagree with that, you just like, you're like, just tell me what happened with the shooting. I'll decide whether this means we should have voted for Democrats more. But it never comes down to that. And it's just this, the news is making itself increasingly irrelevant to people's lives because they jump straight to the, if you've ever seen the movie Speechless, where they talk about the, you see Timmy, joking about how the end of every episode of Lassie, you see Timmy, this is why we should always be honest with people, or some sort of, you know, very simple moral message at the end of it. The moral message at the end is always, and this is why you should vote for Democrats. And yet, strangely, the electorate doesn't always receive that message, kind of like they're being getting really tired of hearing it.
So MBD, Colorado has a red flag law, which didn't catch this guy, despite conduct that would make him getting flagged entirely warranted. Reaction to this shooting and others will lead to more robust red flag laws around the country, or the idea that these things don't really work and aren't effective.
The idea that these things don't work and aren't really effective. We said on this podcast previously, I think I said, the problem with red flag laws is that the people for whom they are intended to restrain are the ones least likely to be surrounded by caring community and family that would intervene. And those who would intervene would have intervened before it reached this acute level in most cases, whether that be committing them to a psychiatric facility or intervening to stop their psychotic fantasies, whatever. But it's precisely people who are cut off and have a meth addicted father and, like this Colorado shooter who, you know, the red flag law won't touch them.
Charlie.
Well, it may lead to that conclusion. And I think with a generalized warrant, but what it should lead to in this particular case is anger at the authorities in that part of Colorado for not having charged him when he went crazy and called in a bomb threat and made a violent nuisance of himself. Because if he had been charged and convicted, I don't see much evidence that he wasn't guilty of it, there's a video, then he would have been flagged, not under the subjective red flag system, but in the background check system when he went to buy a gun. At the very least, his possession of that gun would have been criminalized. So if anything, and I'm very wary of generalizations here because every case is different, as I said earlier, but if anything, this should lead people to question whether we are letting people who have violent intent go free and thereby not availing ourselves of the various prophylactic measures we put in place to stop them buying guns and shooting up clubs.
Jim Garrity.
Very little has changed on this issue for a long, long time, and I don't think anything will change.
That was an MBD-like sigh. So you might get some more robust red flag laws, you know, more allowances for the police to act. But I'm with Charlie. The way the police and the authorities can act is not being lax when people prove themselves to have violent inclinations. This has played into some of the school shootings where you don't have discipline and just sort of put up with kids that people are afraid of and clearly at some level represent a threat. So when someone presents themselves in that way, get something on their record that makes it impossible for them to buy a gun. Nothing is a complete answer here. Unfortunately, this is an ingrained part of our culture now. It's heartbreaking. It's terrible. But at least that might help at the margins. With that, let me do a real quick NR Plus plug. Digital subscription service at nationalreview.com. Your way around our metered paywall. Your way, if you sign up and log in, to see many, many, many fewer ads. Your way to dive deeper into the NR community. If you want, you can comment on articles and blog posts. Be part of our private Facebook group. Get exclusive invitations to events and discussions. Won't cost you an arm and a leg. We have great first-time offers running at any given moment. Plus, perhaps most importantly, it is a way to support our really valuable journalism. So if you haven't signed up yet, or you're looking for Christmas gifts, tis the season, either sign up yourself or gift a subscription to someone else and join tens of thousands of your fellow National Review readers as a member of NR Plus. Let's hit a few other things before we go. Jim Garrity, you weathered the rain and the elements and being at what I consider one of the worst stadiums in the country and one of the most mal-located stadiums in the country to see an amazing Jets victory and the beginning of the Mike White era.
Well, technically, the Mike White era began when he beat the Cincinnati Bengals last year. But then he quickly got injured, looked terrible against the Bills, and went back to the bench. Yes, I was there. Yes, it was monsoon-like conditions. I was telling my wife and my concerned mother, "Oh, don't worry, we'll be over the we're far enough back that we're covered by the level above us." We were about four rows ahead of that, so no, we were not covered by much of anything. So we were all covered in our ponchos, but it was a terrific Jets win. I was able to see it with a big chunk of my family, so we're never going to forget this. Your point about the location. Well, look, if you're coming from the South in New Jersey, that's fine, Rich. That's the local, that's right where it is. My biggest problem, and I just don't understand, how did MetLife not end up the corporate sponsor for the Mets Stadium out in Queens? And then the appropriate corporate sponsor for a football stadium shared by the Jets and the New York Giants would be JetBlue. How did they not work? How did they not work?
So did
that
you
out?
StubHub these tickets? Did you get them on StubHub?
I did, yes.
StubHub is one of the greatest inventions of our era. Whenever Peter Thiel says we're in an age of technological stagnation, just think of StubHub. Because it used to be, you know, you either couldn't get the tickets or you have to buy them really early or you'd have to scalp and not always reliable. You know, you didn't know what you're getting. So StubHub's just fantastic.
Yeah, I flew into San Francisco a few years ago for an NRA event and somehow my plane was about an hour and a half early. And so I just went on StubHub. And I got a ticket to go and see the Giants-Yankees game at, well, I call it AT&T Park. I think it's now called Oracle Park. Just on my phone, I, you know, didn't have to print anything out. Just got the barcode to my phone, walked to the stadium from my hotel, saw the game, and then went to the event. I mean, that would just be unthinkable a few years ago.
Yeah, speaking of stadiums.
Wait. I'm a traditionalist. I miss the days of going to RFK Stadium to catch a Nationals game, wait until the second inning, you know, and then like roll up to a couple people who look like they're totally blazed out on drugs and ask them if they've got tickets. And they usually do, and they were real cheap. Come on. Scalping was fun.
I only had two bad experiences with scalping. One was in Chicago at Wrigley Field, where the guy, it was kind of cold day in the spring, and he swore these were bleacher seats in the sun, and I didn't look carefully enough, and they were actually, they would have been great if there had been a monsoon, Jim, but there wasn't, and they're undercover back behind home plate, and it was just miserable. And then to my great embarrassment, I was with someone once who was writing a story about the WNBA at the inception. And we tried to buy tickets for whatever the New York Liberty, I think it's New York Liberty, and scalped them and got ripped off for a WNBA game, which is highly, highly embarrassing. So MBD, you had some Thanksgiving surprises.
Yeah, well, the surprises in that, you know, one person couldn't come, and then another household family members actually were disinvited from a Thanksgiving they were planning to attend, and so were looking for another table to come to, and ours was open. So I don't know. It was just a fun way to spend the holiday, of like seeing our guest list change morning of two or three times. And still having plenty of food and fun for everyone. So I don't know, it was a great Thanksgiving.
So Charlie, speaking of football, Trevor Lawrence.
Wow. What a finish to the game. I've been complaining about the Jaguars this season, not as usual because they are terrible, but because they really didn't deserve their 3-7 record. They had more points for than against. They had led in 9 of the 10 games. They led in the fourth quarter in 7 of the 10 games, and they were 3-7. And it just seemed that they were almost the reverse Vikings. You know, mm-hmm. The Vikings have squeaked past over and over again, and the Jaguars have lost over and over again. Well, it looked as if they were going to lose by a single score yesterday as well. They were down a touchdown with 1:13 to go, no timeouts. And then Trevor Lawrence put on a masterclass. They got the touchdown. Then with 10 seconds left, they went for two. They got that and they won the game. And I think for anyone who doubts Lawrence's ability or who wonders that if he's going to be a bust, first off, watch that video. The NFL tweeted it out yesterday and just said it was a perfect drive. But I was reading some statistics about Lawrence yesterday and they surprised me. So Lawrence has more games with 100 plus passer rating this season than Josh Allen, Justin Herbert, Kirk Cousins, Aaron Rodgers, Dak Prescott, Lamar Jackson, Russell Wilson, Kyler Murray, and Tom Brady. How about that? He's first in completion percentage this month.
Got the so is QB rating a real like a real indicator?
Well, I mean, I think if you combine those stats with the fact that the Jags have been so close, you can see that their issue is not Trevor Lawrence.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think in and of itself you would look at that and say that means he's better than Josh Allen or extrapolate anything of great import out of it. But, you know, some of the sports press have said, well, the Jags are 3-7. This is his second season. Maybe he's a bust. And I've just never really understood this argument. And not just because of yesterday's drive at the end, although that is exactly the sort of drive that a great quarterback will be able to put on and heralds great things, I hope. But if you then look at the stats, you can see it's, you know, he's not costing them games. He's not,
I've always been suspicious of QB rating since it was a key part of your case for Gardner Minshew in the magazine piece you wrote several years ago.
Well, the problem with that was twofold. First off, the rest of the Jags team at that point was not especially good. And the second thing is, unfortunately, he couldn't keep it up, but he started monumentally well, and then he was worked out. And I think that's another difference with Lawrence, is rather than starting well and then the other teams sort of working out his weaknesses, we're now looking at a monumental performance in game 11, which is
so is Minshew still in the league? Is he backing up somewhere?
I think he was playing backup at the Eagles. I don't know if certainly he was 2 or 3 weeks ago.
Speaking of backup, you know, this is not a football podcast, but I was just thinking, you know, with the Mike White's performance, that has to be one of the worst experiences experiences for a pro athlete to be a quarterback who's benched and have to stand on the sideline with the headphones on and pretend to be delighted, you know, when the guy who's taken your job has an amazing performance the way Mike White did on on Sunday. So I have just completed a book that I've had a galley of sitting around here for a while now that is completely brilliant and fascinating, called Escape from Rome, The Failure of Empire and the Road to Prosperity by a guy named Walter Scheidel. I think he's at Stanford. This is not a narrative history. It's an argument. So I did not read every word because it tends to be repetitive because it wants to pound home its points. But the basic argument is that Rome had to fall, that it was a good thing that Rome fell, and an absolutely essential thing that there was no empire to replace it the way there was in the rest of the old world. And this created the possibility for a polycentric Europe that created rival centers of power that meant that, you know, there wasn't one emperor that could make a disastrous decision, you know, the way the Chinese did, like, oh, we're not going to do any navigation or exploration anymore. We're just going to stop that and burn all the ships. If, you know, a king or queen in Europe had decided that, the explorer would just go someplace else. You know, this is Christopher Columbus and others. They just went from one court to the other. And that element of competition was absolutely crucial in terms of the economy, in terms of warfare, all the rest of it. So this is really an eye-opening way to look at the sweep of Western history. With that, it's time for our editor's picks. MBD, what's your pick?
My pick is a little piece by Andy McCarthy on Trump's dinner with Fuentes and Ye renews a key question for GOP voters. Basically, just I'm not sure I'm totally with Andy on this, but he thinks that the wheels are coming off Trump, that we're watching the end of Trump in a way, the happening gradually, then all at once phenomenon is upon us. And I think that's a perspective worth hearing, especially from Andy, who was probably more positive on Trump than a lot of us at times.
Jim Garrity, what's your pick?
I'm going to go with Michael Brendan Doherty's Two Cheers for Elon Musk's Twitter. It is, you know, not three cheers, meaning it recognizes that, you know, Musk is going to make some errors along the way. But the general thrust of his approach, which is absolutely enraging the progressive establishment, and the people are beside themselves because they feel like they're losing a part of their identity because of the changes at Twitter, only demonstrates how necessary these changes were if Twitter was going to be anything of use. And MBD just, you know, summarizes, goes through it all, and demonstrates just how unhinged the philosophy at work in the previous iteration of Twitter.
Yeah, there's this piece by this guy at New Yorker just came across this weekend who quit Twitter, a progressive guy. And one, it's so telling. He says, you know, we organized these protests after the killing of George Floyd. It started online, it started on social media, and then it spread to the streets. So that's clearly the utility that they found in Twitter. And they're worried that Elon Musk is going to stamp that out. He's not. And then it had this line in here: this is great what's happening to Twitter right now because it proves that Elon Musk isn't a genius. And that's just so ridiculous. Even if he fumbles away Twitter and it goes bankrupt, you know, everything else he has done is proof of his business genius. Charlie Cook, what's your pick?
I want to second Michael's post. I have been critical of some of the decisions that Musk has made. I think his approach to verification was a disaster, although he's now reversed course. But the choice he has made to fire most of the people at Twitter, I think, was a good one. And I think it will provide us with a control experiment of sorts, as Michael points out. What happens when you have a major institution such as this one that is not bloated and that is not held hostage by people on the bleeding edge of whatever fad comes along in progressive politics? And I suspect that the answer is going to be very positive.
So my pick is a forthcoming piece in the magazine, I believe is going to be the cover story by Ramesh, making the case against Trump as only Ramesh can, with surgical precision. So that's it for us. You've been listening to a National Review podcast. Any rebroadcast, retransmission, or countless game without the express written permission of National Review Magazine is strictly prohibited. This podcast has been produced by the incomparable Sarah Schutte, who makes us sound better than we deserve. Thank you, Charlie. Thank you, Jim. Thank you, MBD. Thanks to Firebabble and Brian Kilmeade's new paperback. And thanks especially to everyone for listening. We're the editors. We'll see you next time.